Good morning and welcome to Cool Science Radio, science and technology in a complicated world that's interesting, fun, and accessible. I'm John Wells. I'm here with my co-host, Lynn Ware Peak. We have a fascinating show for you this morning. Our first guest, Mary Roach, author of Gulp, Adventures on the Alimentary Canal. Roach has been called America's funniest science writer, and she's not afraid to tackle taboo subjects or details. Stay tuned as we explore the alimentary canal from top to bottom. We'll start at the mouth, go down the esophagus, into the stomach, through the intestines, well, out the other end.
Can you make it sound a little more romantic?
Well, you know, Lynn, we haven't gone on a road trip in a while, and I thought this would be fun.
A fun road trip through the alimentary canal. Indeed. Well, good morning to you, John. I'm Lynn Ware Peak. Our second guest this morning is Dr. Pearl Sandick. She's an assistant professor in the Department of Physics and Astronomy at the University of Utah, where she studies particle physics beyond the Standard Model, including dark matter. Her research involves the connections between theoretical particle physics, cosmology, and astrophysics. Pearl will be talking about the discovery of ripples in space that may provide validation for the Big Bang theory. And stay tuned for this, because this will be the lay people's look into the Big Bang theory, won't it, John?
Certainly will.
All that plus today's cool story when we return. Stay with us. Cool Science Radio, only in Park City, only on KPCW. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Kelly from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake, and both offer complete design services. We're on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
Hi, this is Steve Roney with Prudential Utah Real Estate, a proud supporter of KPCW. With more than 100 sales associates and 14 gallery or ski-in offices in Park City, Prudential Utah can help you with your residential or commercial real estate needs. More information at pru-utah.com or with the Prudential Utah mobile search app.
This is Michelle from Peak Art and Frame, proud supporters of KPCW. Locally owned and operated, Peak Art and Frame features local photography and artwork, as well as digital printing, custom framing, and mirrors. Open 7 days a week, rush service available, located in the Walmart Shopping Center, 649-0801, peakartandframe.com.
Looking for a fun family activity? Park City Film Series and the Park City Library are co-hosting free films and educational activities for kids of all ages at the Jim Santee Auditorium, 1255 Park Avenue. Hi, this is Katie Wang, Executive Director of the Park City Film Series, inviting you and your family to come check out our Books to Movies program on the first Saturday of every month at 3 p.m., creating the next generation of cinephiles at the Park City Film Series, a nonprofit organization. ParkCityFilmSeries.org.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with John Wells. Well, while we're waiting to get Mary Roach on the phone here, she is the author of Gulp, Adventures on the Alimentary Canal, and she must be adventuring on that canal right now because we're having difficulty getting her on the phone. But in the meantime, John, let's go to today's... I think we have her. I believe we have her. So let's stand by for Mary Roach.
Hello, Mary. How are you?
Very well. How are you?
Good. Let me do a quick introduction, and we'll start our conversation. So I'm John Wells here with my co-host, Lynn Ware Peak, and our first guest, Mary Roach, is the author of Gulp, Adventures on the Alimentary Canal. Roach is known for her fun and informative books about science, including the book Stiff, The Curious World of Cadavers, and her book, Packing for Mars, The Curious Science of Life in the Void. In her new book, Gulp, you may squirm just a little bit, but you're going to have fun and you're going to learn a lot. Mary, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. In preparation for interviews, Lynn and I, we read a lot of science and technology books. And in addition to your book being informative and a celebration of the marvels of the human body, Gulp is also funny, and Lynn and I both appreciate your sense of humor.
thank you.
And by the way, three chapters on flatulence. That's perfect.
Well, you've got volume, you've got odor, and you've got flammability. So you really need to break it down, I feel.
And I couldn't agree with you more. So why don't we start at the top of the canal? We'll work our way down. Let's talk about this amazing substance called saliva. Take us through saliva's various functions.
Sure. Well, saliva, the obvious one, of course, that everybody knows is that it moistens your food and it holds the particles together and helps you form the bolus, one of my favorite words, the bolus of food that you will send down the esophagus. But the other thing that is going on that is amazing that I had no idea, and you can demonstrate this to yourself, if you drink something acidic, something high in acids like cola or orange juice, or wine, very acid substances like that, you're putting your tooth enamel in peril. So what happens, and you can feel this happening, you take a swallow of wine, you will feel this gush of moisture come into your mouth. If you're paying attention, it's quite remarkable. And what that's doing is diluting the acid. It's bringing the pH level in the mouth down to a safe level so you don't dissolve your tooth enamel. Because you talk to people who don't produce saliva, they have a lot of decay, tooth decay. It's quite dramatic. So it's doing that. Saliva's also got antibacterial, antiviral properties. It speeds healing. You see animals lick wounds, and there was a study where they prevented prevented them from licking the wound. The wounds heal more slowly if they can't lick them. They actually disconnected the salivary gland, so the saliva wasn't being applied to the wound. So it's kind of this miracle substance that we all find really, really disgusting.
And in reading your book, I didn't experience what you had spoken about, taking like a sip of wine or putting a drop of vinegar on your tongue and the gush of saliva, until I read it in your book, and I tried it last night several times with several tastings
of wine.
But it absolutely works. It's a gush of saliva and sort of saliva to the...
It's quite amazing.
Interestingly, all these wonderful things about saliva... Once they leave the body, though, spit, for an example, it just repels everybody.
It's a taboo substance. It's interesting because you can really define the boundaries of the self. There was a study, a psychologist who studies disgust did this study where he had people imagine their favorite soup and say how inclined they would be to consume this soup. And now he said, imagine spitting into that soup. And now how likely and excited would you be about eating your favorite soup? And all of a sudden, nobody's going to touch the soup. And it's such a powerful off-putter, a taboo substance. And researchers who study the effect of saliva also has an enzyme that breaks down starch. And there's a researcher in the Netherlands who wanted to study how amylase, when it breaks down starches, how this affects the flavor. Does it make things more flavorful? But he couldn't say to his subjects, okay, spit in your custard, because then they wouldn't eat it, and they couldn't tell him how it affected the taste. So he had to take saliva samples, pretending to be doing something else with them, and then secretly add the saliva like a spiteful waitress, and then do it that way, because they wouldn't. Otherwise, he couldn't do it.
The spiteful waitress. That's the first time we've ever heard of that, Mary. Living in a town where many, many people work in restaurants.
I was a waitress myself, and I never spit in anyone's food.
Same here. I can be 100% honest about that. It's just too gross.
Well, I've never been a waiter, but I've spit in soup.
So it's so funny. As you speak about saliva, my thoughts go to my sister, who's a very, earth mama kind of gal. And she, when she had young children and they would scrape themselves, she always spit on it. On their scrape.
Yeah.
And she talked about that. Another thing she did when she had infants or, very young babies, she would chew their food first and then give it to them. That sounds like she's kind of like a bird. And why do birds
right,
do that?
That's what birds do for their young. That's right. Well, that's actually that's an alternative to baby food. There are humans, people. There are people who do pre-chew food and give it to babies. That's the I don't know where it's done, but it is something that is done. You know, not commonly in our culture, but that's a way to because you're kind of pre. You're starting the digestive process there right. In your own mouth, and you're and babies don't have they can't chew, so you're doing it for them. But the saliva, it's interesting. Baby drool has higher levels of lipase, which breaks down fats. Uh-huh. And babies, one of the reasons it's thought that babies have produced so much drool, so much saliva, is that they're having to break down
a lot of
its mother's milk. Yeah, so they don't have teeth to hold it in their mouth. So
right.
It's dribbling out, but there is a difference in between baby drool and adult saliva, which I love that science knows that the science of drool.
Yeah. Oh, this is so great. What's also great, I was so relieved to know that I produce 2 to 3 pints of saliva every day. I love that.
I know. If it were beer, you'd be drunk.
Yeah, exactly. But what about the people who don't produce that? You talked about the dry mouth people. I mean, what has gone wrong with their constitution that they don't produce saliva? And are these the people that have halitosis? I want to ask you about halitosis.
Well, there are a couple of things going on when people aren't producing saliva. Sometimes it's something, the Sjogren's syndrome. There's certain syndromes that cause this, and there's also if you have had radiation treatment for oral cancers, I believe that can damage the salivary glands. So there's different things going on. But when you don't have saliva, the first thing that happens, you see this tremendous tooth decay because that protection from the acids isn't happening. So that and plus just trying to, I mean, do you chew a cracker without, there's no way to do this yourself, but to try to chew and swallow a cracker without saliva, you cannot do it. You can't form the bolus, as they say. So that's also going on. Yeah, saliva, when you wake up in the morning because you haven't had a lot of saliva production, you've got the bacteria kind of go crazy. They're not being swept away. Saliva has antibacterial properties as anti-clumping, it kind of prevents the bacteria from gaining a foothold in the mouth, and so that kind of fights decay. So you've got kind of an overpopulation of bacteria in the mouth overnight, and so there's more breakdown, and it's all the smell. The smell usually comes from protein breaking down. So you've got your and in your mouth, it's your own cells and things that you've eaten, and so that stuff breaking down has an odor. Morning breath has a distinctive odor compared to the sort of day to day all day halitosis. Also, things that you're eating like garlic, that's actually coming out on your breath. It's getting into the bloodstream and then it's being exhaled. So garlic, you can brush your teeth all you want. You're not going to avoid garlic breath. So there's like three or four different kinds of bad breath.
Oh, great.
Usually just exclusive and disgusting.
And you mentioned smell. I thought it was interesting. You know, we have taste buds on our tongue, but what really determines or has probably a larger role in determining taste is through the olfactory. Like if you have a sip of wine and the wine is wafting up to your nose, but so the taste buds have a role, but the olfactory plays a larger role.
Yeah, about 80% is olfactory. The tongue, people think it's all in the tongue. The tongue is your basic. It's the shirt and pants. It's sweet, sour, salty, bitter, and that other one that joined the club, umami. And everything else, chocolate, wine, particularly with wines, with a lot of volatile aroma components, the wine or alcohol or beer, cheeses, chocolates, all of lemon and citrus, all of these wonderful things that we experience when we eat, most of that 80% is through the nose, through the sense of smell, the olfactory system.
So what's interesting is you've got the taste buds, and then we talk about 80% through the olfactory. And You had an example in your book, which was really interesting, that we process visual information 10 times faster than the olfactory. And the example that you had in your book was someone took white wine and disguised it with red wine without changing the taste. And by visually looking at that red wine, it tricked the mind into thinking that they were drinking this Cabernet.
Yeah, that's right. And these were actually wine people. They were fairly quote unquote educated palates, and they took took a red wine and they had people describe it, and people were using the red wine descriptors that they tend to use, and then they said, okay, now we're going to give you another red wine, which was actually secretly a white wine that had been colored red, and they then began to use. Again, red wine descriptors and not white wine, because the visual system tends to trump the information from the mouth. I mean, I had that experience at a dinner in New York when Gulp first came out. It was a dim restaurant. I'd been presented with this plate of food, and I thought, this is the toughest, blandest fish I've ever had. And this is a fairly nice restaurant. It turned out it was a chicken breast that had been hammered flat, so it looked like fish. And my brain was going, all right, this is a really tough, bland piece of fish. I was like, even though I'm tasting, it was chicken. But anyway, it's very easy to fool people visually with the foods they eat.
If you're just joining us, our guest is Mary Roach. She's the author of the New York Times bestseller, Gulp. And it's all about adventures on the alimentary canal. So if we're working our way down, Mary, one of the great things about your book that our listeners should know is that you tell all of these hilarious stories from history. And as I was reading through it, I thought, can this be real? And one of those is about the French voyageur and Beaumont and Martin's Hole. And Martin was this guy who had his stomach hanging out, stomach lining after being shot. And the researcher, Beaumont, was so excited about this hole in his stomach that he could do research on his gastric juices flowing out. So this is getting down into the what happens in our stomach.
Yes, this was William Beaumont was an army physician, and Alexis St. Martin was at a fur trapper outpost, accidentally shot, ended up with a hole in his stomach that didn't heal properly. And Beaumont, the physician, realized he could put his eye up to the hole. He could actually, with a light source, presumably, see the stomach contractions and see these juices being secreted. And he thought, this is my way to, stake my claim in the history of medicine, and I'm going to investigate this, and I'm going to use St. Martin as my guinea pig. And for 30-some years, this pair would get together. I mean, St. Martin was paid. Eventually, he was paid. Then he'd quit. He'd get fed up and take off. And then Beaumont would send someone out to find him and offer him more money. And it went on and on. It was this kind of mutual dependency and fueled by science and a need to pay the rent. And Beaumont published a book, ultimately, a fascinating book. He would put a mesh bag. He'd put different kinds of food. He'd put it in the stomach, pull it out at different intervals, see what was left, how quickly it was liquefied. And it was the first time anyone had done this with a human being. There were some researchers in Italy about 100 years before that who had done some work with animals. So it was known that there was a chemical process. But I don't think not a lot of folks were familiar with that work at the time. So Beaumont was a pioneer in physiology and is kind of hailed for his creative approach to the experimental method. I mean, it just goes on and on. One chapter is effects of the weather on the gastric juices, and he'll very detailed notes of 10 a.m. inserted boiled beef and 10:25 a.m. withdrew bag. I mean, it's a very illuminating look at the early scientific process.
Right. You know, so many times you must have said in your research, ooh, that's really gross and cool at the same time, because those are the two words that when I read your book, I was thinking, ooh, that's gross, but pretty cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's kind of I would say that's my specialty right there. Gr- Gross, but cool.
Yeah.
Well, Mary, we should continue down the canal, but I just wanted to go back to taste just for a moment. You had a sensory consultant named Sue Lagstaff that was helping you with your book and your research from the beer industry. And she mentioned that the United States is a dumping ground for bad olive oil. What is it about our inability to discern between good and bad olive oil?
Well, that is that's an education process. People like Sue Lagstaff speak a language of flavor. It's they educate themselves in this very. It's a very intentional process. You start out. You can actually do this yourself. There's a kit for wine. People who want to learn to appreciate wine, where the different chemical components that cause you to experience a blackberry. I mean, you learn those smells individually, and then you can tease apart the flavors that you're experiencing in your mouth and nose. So you're almost learning a language. You begin to identify these things that normally you just go, oh, that's tasty. You don't break it down. So we as Americans don't go to olive oil tastings the way we go to wine tastings. We haven't learned how to do that. And the olive oil is not. I tried out to be an olive oil flavor panelist and failed miserably, because to me they all seem fine. I was presented with one that was technically rancid, and I'm like, give me a piece of bread. This is great. I didn't notice it. It wasn't rank or offensive. It was a subtlety that was beyond me. To me, they were all kind of peppery finish with some grassy smells. I mean, I could not tell the subtleties because I've never learned that process. Whereas there are people in the room who are in the olive oil industry. They were able to detect, you know, melon or things that for the life of me, I couldn't pull that out of what I was experiencing. So we just aren't educated in the same way Italians are, or Europeans in general have had more experience with olive oil. They just have learned to make discriminations that the average wine drinker in America now can do because of wine tastings and the whole growth of the wine appreciation.
Well, Mary, we know you have a hard out at 29 after the hour. That's correct, right?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Because we didn't get to speak about flatulence, which is unfortunate. But we wanted to thank you very much for joining us. You've written a great book, Gulp: Adventures on the Alimentary Canal. And as I mentioned earlier, it's really a celebration of the marvels of the human body. It's informative and it is funny. Thank you for joining us.
And again, that was Mary Roach. And that book is, I mean, I'm not sad, but sad at the same time that we didn't get to Noxious Flatus and her three chapters on that.
Yeah.
But it is very, very interesting. So a great book to pick up, and you will never be bored, I can tell you that much. And you'll learn a lot more about what goes on in that body of yours.
That is for sure. Well, I tell you what, we're going to take a break, and we will be back. We want to thank Mary for joining us, Gulp: Adventures on the Alimentary Canal. And next, when we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Pearl Sandick, who's an assistant professor at the Department of Physics and Astronomy at the University of Utah. We'll be talking to her about the discovery of ripples in space that may provide validation for the Big Bang Theory. You're listening to Cool Science Radio. Only in Park City, only on KPCW.
One day it's sunny, next day it's snowing.
Then it's rainy, now it's clear.
It just doesn't know what to do.
No pressure, whatever the weather does.
Our forecast is for fun. The hot things to do and the cool places to be.
Get the inside scoop from your outside-the-box hosts, John and Jan, on Fun Friday.
Thanks to our all-weather sponsors,
Foothill Oriental Rugs,
Wasatch Pub, Squatters Pub and Brewery. Please consult your meteorologist. Listening may cause laughter.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Longrimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, lrw-law.com. Brett Stimson, mortgage assistant for home purchases, 801-201-3484. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with my co-host, John Wells. Well, our next guest this morning is Dr. Pearl Sandick. She's an assistant professor in the Department of Physics and Astronomy at the University of Utah, where she studies particle physics beyond the standard model, including dark matter. Her research involves the connections between theoretical particle physics, cosmology, and astrophysics. But don't worry, because she's going to explain all of that in a very palatable and accessible way for those of us who are lay people to these very complicated sounding subjects. Pearl will also be talking about the discovery of ripples in space that may provide validation for the Big Bang theory. This was first theorized in 1979 and has only been recently proven. Dr. Pearl Sandick, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
Well, it's nice to have you, and of course, our listeners and us as well. We are somewhat lay people, very interested in science and what goes on. And I know that when every time you hear about the Big Bang theory, we all sort of know what it is, but maybe we should get an explanation from you. I mean, it's really the leading explanation for the origins.
Right, for why things are the way they are. So actually, if you ask scientists, there are somewhat different interpretations of what Big Bang actually means. But the idea is that the universe is currently expanding. That means that if we look out at galaxies, distant galaxies, they're moving away from us. And the farther away the galaxy, the faster it's moving away from us. So this was something that was discovered by Edwin Hubble back in the 1920s. But if you look at the process in reverse, so if you reverse time, then everything should be moving towards us, right? So if you go back into the early universe, everything would have been much smaller and closer together, you could say. And so following it all the way back to the beginning, things would have been infinitely concentrated in a single point. And that's what people mean when they say the Big Bang, that everything sort of emanated. It's basically just the reverse of what we're observing today.
Right. So it has inflated, the universe has inflated essentially over the last, well, there are varying arguments about the last how long, how many billion years, but somewhere between 10 and 20 billion years, right?
Right, about 14 billion years. And it's interesting that you use the word inflation, which is actually, you know, cosmologists and physicists use that word to describe something very particular that's different, actually. It's more extreme than just the standard expansion of the universe. So what we call inflation is a period where the universe grew even faster, where space expanded much faster than the speed of light. And that period of inflation, or that period of the history of the universe, is really important because it smoothed everything out so that when we look out around us, everything kind of looks the same in every direction.
So 13.8 billion years ago to the other side of where Big Bang started, that the acceleration was so quick, and I'm trying to understand this myself, that mm-hmm. the uniformity of the expansion, what you refer to as inflation, because the temperature of all of the matter out there is fairly uniform, that means that it all sort of got out there together. That is what you're talking about?
Yeah, basically. So I think you're talking about the what we call the cosmic microwave background, which is sort of this bath of photons, light particles that are flying around all around us. And most of those light particles traveled to us without really being interrupted along the way from when they were created or the last time they bumped into anything. And the last time they bumped into anything was the last time there was something to bump into, which we call the surface of last scattering. The idea is that in the early universe, so first you have, you know, a quark soup. You have all these elementary particles, and they're all just swimming around. And then the universe cools and expands, and nuclei can form. But you have charged nuclei and the electrons that would be paired with them into atoms, and they're separate. And while they're separate, light particles can scatter off of them. So light just bounces around. If you lived back there, you wouldn't be able to see very far because the light would scatter almost immediately, and so no photons would be able to travel uninterrupted from an object to your eye. Not that there were objects back then anyway. But as the universe further cooled, the nuclei, mostly hydrogen, combined, the protons and electrons combined into atoms, and then light particles could fly right by. And that happened, when that happened, basically those photons will fly directly from that period to us.
And so we call that the surface of last scattering. That's what we actually observe when we observe the cosmic microwave background. So that happened when the universe was about 380,000 years old, which in the scheme of 14 billion is pretty young.
Right.
But inflation, so those photons carry one temperature that's fairly uniform. And the little changes in temperature tell us about what was in the universe at the time that those photons were emitted. Now, 380 years old, though, is much, much older than when this inflation happened, the thing that is purported to have been discovered.
At probably like a trillionth of a second or something.
Yeah, so the number that's been flying around is a trillionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a second. It's a really, really short period of time.
So Einstein, of course, said in relativity that the speed limit of the universe is 186,000 miles a second, the speed of light. So this inflation was exponentially faster than the speed of light.
Yeah, that's right. So special relativity says basically that information can't travel faster than the speed of light. So the speed limit for objects that we experience is the speed of light. However, it doesn't say anything about how fast space can expand. So space is allowed to expand much faster than the speed of light. And the stuff in the space, the objects, or even the particles of light, they're just really along for the ride.
Oh, very interesting.
So, Dr. Sandek, I want to go, before we start talking about these newly discovered ripples that sort of do a further job in proving the Big Bang theory, maybe moving it a little more out of the theory realm and into, I don't know, what's the next step? Fact, I guess you would call that. I want to ask you a little bit about, looking when the Big Bang theory was first, when physicists or astronomers, I guess, first came up with it, it was developed through a series of mathematical models because they couldn't be looked at, that many billion years ago. You couldn't see it. But now as we're coming up with these really powerful telescopes, you're able to look, and this is such a hard concept for me to grasp, but you're able to look further back in time. Is this how we were able to see these ripples?
Yeah, it is. So telescopes can look farther back in time by virtue of the fact that photons are traveling to us from the time when they were emitted. And so the photons that we see now were emitted some time ago. And light travels at the speed of light, so you can figure out how far away the thing would be. However, that's one way that we're able to look farther back in time. The cosmic microwave background is an example of us. Those photons came to us from that surface of last scattering, the last time they bumped into each other, anything.
Okay.
Now, the gravitational waves that were observed, though, they were actually observed sort of in the cosmic microwave background, but they were observed by the imprint that evidence of the inflationary epoch left on the cosmic microwave background. So we can't really see photons that came from before then, in the sense that you would look out with a telescope and see something really old. But we can see the evidence of what happened before that by how it left an imprint in the cosmic microwave background.
Well, the cosmic microwave background, and we're going to be talking about this later in the show, is roughly, it was discovered 60 years ago by those two gentlemen at Bell Labs. How come it took so long to see the gravitational waves?
Oh, because the signal is very, very tiny. So the cosmic microwave background, as you say, was discovered in 1964, I think, by Penzias and Zoltzen at Bell Labs by total accident. They didn't know, they weren't looking for it. It just happened to show up. And since then, we've been trying to analyze it. So it was predicted before that, and then it was observed. And now we've been trying to figure out what you can see by looking at those photons that come from so long ago. And one thing that you can see is the pattern of matter in the universe then, how the matter was distributed and what it was made of. And so that signal is like one part in 10 to the fifth of the signal-to-noise ratio, I guess, or if you want to say it. So you're looking for something that's, 1 inch tall on something that's like a mile. So it's really difficult to see that. So they did that, and that was discovered maybe like 10 or so years ago. And that allowed us to figure out what the universe was made of. And now what we're looking for is a signal that's a factor of 10 to the fifth smaller than that. So a much, much smaller signal is what is encoding the information about the inflationary epoch.
And Einstein originally theorized this, but then he threw it out. Is that something that is that has happened recently that is that, that could potentially prove Einstein's belief that there were gravitational waves?
Yeah. So, I guess Einstein had some moments of self-doubt too, like we all do.
Yeah. Even Einstein.
Yes, even Einstein. But basically, everything that has happened, all of the results, the experimental results that we have, are confirming Einstein's theories. And so, you know, whether or not he had a moment of self-doubt about whether the universe was expanding or not, things are certainly confirming it. And actually, the evidence for the expansion of the universe, it was experimental, really, as much as it was theoretical. But Hubble's data came only from very nearby galaxies because they didn't have very powerful telescopes then.
Mm. It's interesting. So this telescope that detected these ripples is located at the South Pole. And of course, and I'm curious if you're involved at all in the development of the James Webb telescope right here. It's in the Salt Lake Valley being developed in Magna, I believe. Is that right?
Oh, wow. I don't actually know. I have to confess, I'm a theoretical physicist and cosmologist, and so I'm so interested in the results and so interested in what's happening with that, but I don't have my hands on anything. I don't think anyone would want me to have my hands on any of that equipment.
Right, right. Well, okay, so the James Webb Telescope, which is due to be launched a million miles into space in another, I don't know, 3 or 4 years, being developed at... I'm blanking on the name of the laboratories. It'll come to me in it. Howell, ATK.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So I guess what I'm wondering about these telescopes, so this one that discovered the ripples in space recently is at the South Pole. The James Webb will be propelled into space. Do astrophysicists already know the questions that they want to have answered? They just don't have the technology and the telescopes yet to answer those. Or do they, you know, do they come up with a more powerful telescope and then go, oh, gee, look what we can see now. We never had any idea.
Yeah, so, I mean, in order to get a telescope built, it costs a lot of money. So you have to have a pretty good idea of what you want to discover in order to make the argument that you should get the money for the telescope. So with James Webb is incredibly important, and it'll be a huge achievement when that launches. The James Webb Telescope is it's tremendously large. I think it's the size of some number of tennis courts, and it's going to unfold. So you launch it in a rocket, which is part of ATK's involvement, mm-hmm. and then it goes into space, and once it's in orbit, it unfolds, shields itself from the sun so that it's only looking away from the sun so that it can see those photons and be very sensitive to the light that's coming from it from really far away. And it's going to look back, actually, at really old galaxies and really old stars and be able to see farther into the history of the universe by looking at direct objects than we've ever been able to see before. And so the James Webb Telescope, I mean, part of the reason it was proposed is to look at early star formation, which is really fascinating and may actually have implications for dark matter, which is something that I work on. And similarly with BICEP. BICEP went out looking for a polarization in the cosmic microwave background. Everybody who's wearing polarized sunglasses right now has some idea of what I'm talking about. The BICEP telescope, which is the one that made this discovery of the ripples, went out looking for a specific kind of polarization that's an extremely tiny signal, not only to look for inflation, but also to look for other things.
Yeah, and the fascinating this is just an observation on my part. I'd like your thoughts on it, and that's that we always seem to have a pretty good idea of the questions we want to ask before we build these things and send them out, but we are constantly being surprised. And
yeah.
There's so many remarkable things out there. I wanted to ask you, what is the significance of this? An MIT cosmologist said that this could go down as one of the greatest discoveries in the history of science. Is that a little hype? Or is that true?
No, I think that's absolutely true. It's incredible. I mean, to be able to look back that early in the universe, and one of the reasons why it's so incredible, I mean, knowing where we come from and how we got here, right? This is like a basic human desire is to understand these things. But also, this is something that didn't have to have been discovered. So we actually got really lucky that the signal was as large as it was and that we're able to look at it. One of the leaders of the BICEP collaboration, a guy named Clem Pryke, said it's like going out on a wild goose chase and actually finding the goose. I mean, it was just so lucky and so tremendous that this was discovered as like this total smoking gun right out there, like as soon as they turned their machine on. So it's really incredible, and it changes our paradigm. You know, inflation was something, even until a few weeks ago, when people would give an academic talk on the inflationary universe or some model for inflation, how it happened, they would say, well, you know, we might measure this, but it's possible that the signal is so small that I might not ever see it in my lifetime measured. And it turns out that we measured it. That's amazing.
Well, it is a tremendous accomplishment that'll probably be confirmed over the next, several months. But I'm curious, you know, when I think about Newton and what he came up with understanding gravity and how planets orbit around the sun, and then I think about electricity, penicillin, that the Earth is not flat, that it's round, the DNA double helix. I mean, that's a lot of competition for the greatest discovery in the history of science. Think about the transistor. How about the laser? And the lasers,
yeah, that's
tens
true.
Of thousands of incredible applications for the laser. But I don't doubt that it's very important. I'm just wondering if it's the greatest discovery in the history of science.
Yeah, I mean, it does have a lot of competition, and I will tell you that knowing whether or not inflation happened is probably not going to change anyone's life or cure cancer. But it definitely tells us where we came from and gives us this understanding of something that happened so early in the history of the universe. Understanding where we came from is a pretty incredible thing.
You know, it's funny you said a moment ago, Pearl, that it's a basic human desire to understand these things. But I don't think it is a basic human desire. I think it is for people like you and the people that you work with. And I'm curious about that. You know, a lot of people, I think, purposely shut down that area of their brain that wonders and ponders the things that happen because it's too big and too infinite seeming. Would you agree with that? I mean, you're not involved with people like that. You're involved with people that are on the opposite end.
Well, I think I'm involved with everybody, but you're definitely right. I mean, that's what science is about. It gives us the tools to be able to ask questions in the first place and then figure out how to answer them. And not everyone is a scientist, but I hope that science is something that more people appreciate. Neil deGrasse Tyson was in town last week, and I went to hear his talk, and he spoke a lot about this, actually, that, you know, everyone has this, you know, little kids ask questions about everything. They want to know the answers and they want to explore. And eventually we tell them, no, don't touch that, you know, only ask these questions because we know the answers to them. And it sort of like gets worked out of kids.
Yeah.
And so I think we actually, you know, in my opinion, curiosity is something that is innate. What happens after that is the problem.
You know, you are so right. And thank goodness we have people like Neil deGrasse Tyson who really brings it down to the people, you know? He brings the message so that he inspires that sense of wonderment again in people.
Yeah, absolutely.
And a child's sense of wonder. And when they look up into the sky for the first time and just hanging out with your kids when you're walking around and in the course of any given day, we'll ask the question why, could be 100 times. I mean, they have a lot of questions, and maybe as we've gotten older, we've gotten busy with other things, but some have lost that sense of wonder. I'm curious, Doctor, Einstein didn't have, you know, we didn't have technology and we didn't have the modeling capabilities and we didn't collaborate with all these other disciplines like we do now when Einstein was doing all of his work. If Einstein was around today, what do you think he'd be up to?
That's a really interesting question. I don't know. You know, Einstein is somewhat unusual as a scientist because he worked alone a lot. Most of us collaborate with, you know, our colleagues and our friends and bounce ideas off of each other. So I don't know what Einstein would be up to, but I can tell you that for most of us, it works a little bit differently than how it worked for him. He's definitely an exception in a lot of ways.
Yeah. You know, I remember when there was the discovery of the Higgs boson. I don't know if I ever pronounced that right, but that was a year ago or maybe 2 years ago. And, you know, that's been a really confounding, confusing discovery for me to understand, and maybe a lot of other people. Maybe you could explain it a little bit.
Oh, sure. The Higgs boson was discovered in July of 2012. There are actually some similarities with this discovery of inflation, if it pans out, in that it was predicted theoretically, and it was needed to explain some observations about how, in the case of inflation, how the universe works, in the case of the Higgs boson, how particle physics works. And experimentalists went out looking for it, and eventually they found it. And it was, you know, not quite the first place that they looked, not quite the first mass or interactions that they looked for, but it ended up showing up, and that was a huge achievement. I mean, that was one of the main reasons for building the Large Hadron Collider, the giant particle collider that ended up discovering it.
Yeah. Okay. That's good stuff. And I remember seeing a photo on the, in the New York Times in when scientists, upon the discovery of the Higgs boson. And one thing I noticed is it was all a bunch of white hairs. I mean, these are some aging astrophysicists. And it struck me how cool it is that they don't get the people that are discovering are they're elderly a lot of times. So it's not one of those careers or one of those fields that, you know, it takes a young person to bring in new creativity and new technology.
Yeah, not always. I mean, if you look at the pictures of the collaborations of the experiments that discovered the Higgs boson, or the BICEP collaboration that discovered inflation is a much smaller collaboration. But if you look at the pictures, there are people from every generation, from every decade, every walk of life. I mean, it's a cool group of people that share one curiosity in common and a skill set that allows them to work together to make incredible things happen.
Dr. Sandek, every time that there's a question answered, I'm sure you have a lot more questions. When you look at everything out there, what is the one question you'd like to see answered?
Oh, man. So I have two research specialties, and I would like to see both of them answered. So my personal research topics are dark matter. I really want to know what the dark matter is. For those of you who don't know what dark matter is, if you look at a galaxy and how the bodies in that galaxy rotate around the center, if you add up all the mass there that's just due to the stars and the stuff you can see, it doesn't add up to enough to keep it gravitationally bound.
Right.
So there has to be some other matter in that galaxy. And actually, the cosmic microwave background tells us that there's a lot more matter than just the stuff we see, the regular matter. There has to be some other kind of dark matter. And so I would really like to know what that is. And the other thing that I work on is a theory called supersymmetry, which actually, can explain dark matter in some ways. It can explain inflation in some theories, and it can also predict the Higgs boson, actually. So it ties into all the things we've just talked about. But I would love to know whether or not the universe is supersymmetric, and that's something that we might find out, actually, when the LHC turns on again.
It's all very fascinating, and I love that you couldn't narrow in on one question. You had to have the two questions answered. That's a curious mind for
certain.
And
she knows the question she wants answered.
Oh, yeah, you didn't even hesitate.
One is never enough. Oh, two is never even enough. I have so many questions.
Well, Dr. Pearl Sandek, thank you so much for joining us today. And before I let you go, I just have to ask you, you know, you are a female in a world of probably still the majority of your colleagues are male. And I just wanted to ask you about, you know, we're trying to encourage young girls to head into STEM careers and areas of interest. And what would be your suggestion if you were to talk to some young girls to get them excited about science?
Yeah, that is certainly true. Just tell them that they can, that they should always do what they think is fun. Because kids think science is fun, girls and boys alike. And so if you encourage them to keep doing what they think is fun, I think they'll all find their path at the end of the day.
Oh, that's a great answer. Thank you, Pearl Sandek, for joining us today. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Pearl.
And again, that was Dr. Pearl Sandek, and she is an assistant professor in the Department of Physics and Astronomy at the University of Utah, studying the universe, the dark matter. That's very interesting about the dark matter, and we'll be right back to talk more about it. Stay with us. You're listening to Cool Science Radio.
Tune into KPCW every Friday to hear what local film critics have to say about the movies playing in and around town. The KPCW Friday Film Review every week during the local news hour with Leslie Thatcher, with replays after the noon news and again during the local view with Randy Barton. The KPCW Friday Film Review, sponsored by the Utah Film Center.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. We're going to go through our cool story of the day that happens to be 60 years old. So we're just talking about the God particle, and we're talking about waves of gravity and these new discoveries. And during this conversation, we also talked about the cosmic background, which is this microwave, which is basically the smoking gun that there was a Big Bang. Let me tell you a quick story. Lynn and I will both tell you a quick story. If you want to have a satellite, you need to, you know, before you put it up there, you need to figure out if it works or not. So a long time ago, Bell Labs built this huge antenna in Homedale, New Jersey, and they put balloons up and they bounced data off it to see if satellites would actually work, and they did. And then they put up the first satellite, which was the Telstar, and then the device that they had to do all this testing was left abandoned. And a couple of Bell Labs employees, Arno Penzias and Robert Wilson, they wanted to look at some stars with it, so they grabbed this telescope. But they had a
They had a problem, and I think it was maybe the dark matter, like Pearl was talking about. There was this background static. It was like a radio in the microwave range, and they first thought, well, maybe it's extraterrestrials. No, maybe it's New York City and the lights interfering somehow. No, it wasn't. And what was it? Became the question.
So they had this background noise, and they didn't know what it was. And as Lynn just said, they tried everything, and they really couldn't ascertain where it was coming from. But they heard about this guy right down the street from Homedale at Princeton University named Robert Dick. And Robert had a theory that the Big Bang could not have happened unless there was some residual signals floating around. So they went to him. And they said, we may have found what you are looking for.
And they were right. And so this is what ended up getting Penzias and Wilson the Nobel Prize 60 years ago for discovery on that background noise. And that's maybe the first smoking gun for the Big Bang theory.
It was. And it was found in... I mean, they weren't looking for it. This happens in science all the time, and it's, you know, it's a story that I've always enjoyed. It's just because all these things have happened now as a result of it.
Yeah, and a lot of times it's not what you're looking for. It's what happens on the way to looking for something. So
hey,
very good.
We want to thank our guest, Mary Roach, author of Gulp Adventures on the Alimentary Canal, and, of course, Dr. Pearl Sandick, assistant professor, Department of Physics and Astronomy at the University of Utah.
We also want to thank our underwriters, San Francisco Design, Prudential Utah Real Estate, and Peak Art and Frame. Also, Beth Fratkin, our producer. And stay tuned tomorrow for Fun Friday at 9 a.m.
Yeah, it's a spring runoff with the Park City Education Foundation's Running with Ed. So hang in there for that. And also an update on Saturday's Olympian Parade tomorrow.
That's
on Fun Friday.
And you're listening to KPCW Park City. It's your community public radio here at 91.9. Of course, you can always look for archive programs of Cool Science Radio, kpcw.org.